This is Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. This hour, what political consequences will President Biden face from the events in Afghanistan this week? Then, how the U.S. justice system motivates innocent people to plead guilty to crimes they did not do. Also, what allyship looks like in the workplace and how to know if you're doing it right. That's all coming up on Top of Mind. It's good to have you with us. President Biden will forever be known as the U.S. president who lost Afghanistan to the Taliban, or as the president who finally dared to bring America's troops home from a losing battle. Here is how President Biden sees it.
I'm now the fourth American president to preside over war in Afghanistan, two Democrats and two Republicans. I will not pass this responsibility on to a fifth president. I will not mislead the American people by claiming that just a little more time in Afghanistan will make all the difference. Nor will I shrink from my share of responsibility for where we are today and how we must move forward from here. I am President of the United States of America, and the buck stops with me.
What consequences will the events in Afghanistan over this last week have for President Biden politically and for U.S. policy? I'm joined in studio by Grant Madsen and Chris Karpowitz. Grant is a professor of history at Brigham Young University, and Chris Karpowitz is a professor of political science at Brigham Young University. They're both regular guests on Top of Mind. It's good to see you both. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Julie.
Great to be here, Julie.
Chris Karpowitz, why do you think President Biden decided to be the president to rip the Band-Aid off and take the loss in Afghanistan rather than, as he says, he could have passed it on for another 5-10 years like other presidents have before him?
Well, I think there are two things that come to mind immediately. First, even when he was vice president under President Obama, he was not in favor of the surge that occurred at that time. So he was he advocated a much more narrow focus for U.S. troops and wanted to get out. And there's an argument to be made that certainly after the death of Osama bin Laden, that might have been a better path forward, at least in terms of sort of where we are today. So one reason is that he's long been an advocate for bringing this military involvement to a close or drawing it down. The second is that, in fact, there was an agreement negotiated with the Taliban under President Trump to get out in May. That was the agreement that the previous administration negotiated. They negotiated it directly with the Taliban. Mm-hmm. And the Biden administration extended that a little bit. But it seems to me that, at least in terms of how he's talked about it publicly, President Biden saw the choice as being either live up to that agreement or send a lot more troops back in and fight for a longer period of time and with more loss of American lives. And the fact of the matter is there simply hasn't been the political will in Washington, D.C., or in the country at large to continue a kind of open-ended war in Afghanistan. Most Americans aren't paying that much attention. They've sort of forgotten about this war. But when we ask them, most Americans have said, yeah, it's time to come home. And so in that sense, not in terms of how it's actually happened on the ground, but in that sense, in that larger sense of do Americans want to continue to fight war in Afghanistan, the public opinion answer is no.
But do we know if Americans will be happy or are happy with ending that war, with the consequence being that the Taliban is back in control? And so effectively, what did we fight for these last 20 years?
Well, I think most Americans, and certainly I wouldn't want to minimize the sacrifice that members of the American military made in fighting. They went over. They fought honorably. They did their best. They tried to to fulfill the responsibilities that they were given in a straightforward and good way. And many lost their lives in that process. So we should certainly honor that. But in terms of, whether there is some sort of larger consequence in terms of public opinion for this? Well, again, the fact of the matter is, for better or worse, most Americans don't pay much attention to foreign policy. Mm. So even very big foreign policy failures, and I would argue this is a failure of multiple administrations across a very long period of time, don't seem to register very much. I would, however, think that there will likely be at least a short-term hit because the criticism has been so vehement from both sides, both Democrats and Republicans, and because the pictures that we're seeing from, say, Kabul airport are heart-wrenching.
So the bipartisan criticism that he is most likely to face, and certainly is, at least in the short term, is, you know, we could have planned this better. Surely you could have done something to avoid the chaos. Is that right?
I think that there's a widespread sense on both sides of the aisle that in terms of the actual competence of the response here, the planning, it left a lot to be desired. Mm. And I think that that has surprised some people because I think many people were feeling like the Biden administration would do better on some of these fronts than previous administrations. But there have been clear shortcomings here.
Grant Madsen, what's the historical lens that you're looking at this moment through right now?
Well, I think the obvious analogy to the past is Vietnam, which also ended with these images of airlifts taking people out of Saigon and the same kinds of people, right? Those who and this is, I think, what makes it particularly heart-wrenching. It's the people who believed in the United States, who were, you know, on board and wanting to see the U.S. win and helping to advance that position, who now suddenly find their lives threatened. And this sense of, you know, so that there are those who escape and those who remain, you know, are abandoned, right? Mm-hmm. And so the images from Kabul airport are a lot like those Saigon images. So there's that. I think that there's if you'd kind of take a step back and try to think about this, not just in the short-term politics, but the larger kind of policy questions about U.S. power abroad. I mean, there are a lot of similar dynamics, right? So one of the problems that persisted all through the Vietnam conflict is that the United States supported a South Vietnamese government that was never stable and never competent. And that in the long run meant a rapid collapse once the United States military power was removed from the equation. And that's almost exactly what we've seen again in Afghanistan. In fact, in Afghanistan, it's happened a little bit faster, but it's the same dynamic. So that's one. Another part of the dynamic is that it's really hard to build a stable nation and government when there are people all around that nation and government who have a vested interest in seeing it fall. And so once again, we have a situation where the United States is trying to build – well, was trying to build in Afghanistan a stable state where Pakistan was maybe on board but maybe not on board, certainly housed many of the Taliban.
They played both sides of the fence.
Yeah, they played, exactly right.
Yeah.
You know, China is right there and, you know, how does it feel about all this? Russia isn't too far behind. So there are a lot of people who had a vested interest in, if nothing else, at least making the United States look bad. And it's hard to build a nation when those dynamics are played. So
yeah, no, I agree with that, that there are other international dynamics at play here. And I think there's also plenty of blame to go around within the United States. Yeah. And I think part of what we're seeing, just to pick up on that point, Grant, is the limits of American military might. The American military is the most powerful in the world in a whole bunch of ways. But one of the problems in Afghanistan is it wasn't exactly clear at various points what our mission was. And was it simply to get rid of al-Qaeda? That was the initial one. Was it to find Osama bin Laden? And we did that. It took longer than expected. But once that was done, what was the mission? And then it sort of morphed into this very vague nation building.
Which President Biden said that was never our mission. And I was kind of thinking, well, you can say that wasn't the plan, but what else could we call the last 10 years since Osama bin Laden was assassinated?
That's a lesson that the policy world will have to grapple with very deeply. And certainly those who are involved in military policy is we seem to repeatedly get ourselves into this situation where somehow the mission changes beyond a narrow initial mission, and we find ourselves mired in these very protracted battles that, in one sense, aren't going to be winnable in the absence of real political will within the country and the kind of political resources needed to establish a stable democratic or quasi-democratic government.
Grant Madsen, what is it about America that makes us so prone to getting mired in the kind of situation that Chris Karpowitz is describing?
Yeah, so there's a long historical literature on exactly this point. But it goes something like this. For most of history, for most of the world, if you started a war, you did it for basically either money or territory. Right. The winning side took the property of the losing side. And that was the point of the war. And that's why we fought. Roughly speaking, in the United States, since World War I, we have fought wars not to take treasure, not to take territory. And there's some people who would say, no, that's really why we're doing it. But generally speaking, that's not the case. We generally fight wars in order to get people to agree with us that liberal democracy is the best way to govern themselves.
As Woodrow Wilson put it, we fight to make the world safe for democracy.
That's exactly right.
Mm-hmm. And that vision that has animated parts of American foreign policy since the early part of the 20th century, I think is really under stress in the light of things like Vietnam and like Afghanistan. I think there are big differences between those two nations, and there are big differences in the way we fought, right? In Vietnam, we had a draft, and a much larger percentage of the country was at least possible that they would go fight. Now we have an all-volunteer army, and it's easy to kind of forget the sorts of military interventions that we undertake. Nonetheless, I think there are serious questions to be asked about how effective the American military can be in that sort of aim.
Did you see Grant Madsen, President Trump, as rejecting that idea of America fights to make the world safe for democracy?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question, because I think that, I mean, his sort of America first approach certainly lent itself to something like the older, more kind of chauvinistic approach to war. We advance our interests, we take what we need, and then we leave, or something along those lines. Yeah, I think that's a safe statement. But I mean, the problem is that the American public has a very hard time with this notion of fighting wars for treasure and territory.
Is that new, though? I mean, did the American public used to feel better about that, and the war on terror just kind of changed our minds?
No, this is sort of a permanent aspect. Well, okay, so the historian in me wants to nitpick a lot of this. Depending on the war you want to point to, it's different. But as a general rule, particularly since World War I, the American public is on board a war if it can be characterized as a war of liberation that leads to a stable government that is democratic and liberal in the little L sense of, you know, respects rights, and particularly what, you know, today we say human rights, right? So freedom of speech, freedom of religion, protections for women and minorities, and so on.
Okay. And that was a vision that many Americans were on board with in World War II, right?
Yeah.
That we could go and fight the forces of fascism and totalitarianism and create a better world and the United States was unbelievably successful in that process in World War II, in combination with other nations. But we have had a much more difficult time since then with these sorts of things. Now, the interesting thing about the Biden and Trump administrations with respect to Afghanistan is these two are very different administrations in a whole host of ways. But with respect to this particular armed conflict, the policy is exactly the same. Mm. It is get out. And if President Trump had been president, you know, we certainly could have hoped that the execution on the ground would have been different. But the policy to get out and essentially leave the country to the Taliban, that was the negotiated policy under the previous administration.
So what's changed?
I guess in some ways we'd say nothing, right? Like, so the policy is the same from Trump to Biden, and the response from the American Republic is exactly what you would expect in either case.
But what's changed to lead us to a place where the last two U.S. presidents have been willing to get out and sort of begin to shift this idea that our job is to nation build?
Well, okay, so
away
first
from that,
yeah.
Idea.
So first off, I think Chris has asked this question about whether we have to rethink policy. My own suspicion, I speak here as the historian, not the political sciences, we're never getting away from this because here's the dilemma: can ask yourself as Americans, what is a good reason to fight? Like, if our military is going to be engaged, what's a good reason for people to die in order to accomplish our policy goals?
Especially if the actual safety of the American people is not at risk.
Right. And that's why the involvement in Afghanistan, as opposed to, say, the involvement in Iraq, was so popular from the very beginning, right?
Because we were going after Al-Qaeda, which attacked us on our home ground.
These people attacked us. We are going to go defend ourselves, and we will do so aggressively. The problem with the American public's response is not so much that. It's the will to sustain that over long periods of time and to move from that initial sort of we're going to attack those who attacked us to a bigger more complicated, messier mission of nation building, that's where you lose the American people, I think, a lot.
Yeah, but I think what I'm saying is that there's no alternative because that's the only thing we really – that's how we define success.
Yeah.
Right? And to see the Taliban sweep into the nation, to watch those who supported our vision now feeling isolated and alone, the knowledge that we know that this will involve a rollback of human rights, and particularly for women and religious and other kinds of minorities. I mean, that suddenly feels like failure. Mm-hmm. And so even though we could characterize it as a success, right? We did kick the Taliban out. We showed them they can't sponsor terrorism.
We got Osama.
We got Osama,
bin Laden.
Right? It still is going to feel like a failure. And this is part of, I think, the American DNA. Is we tend to think of success when we have made the world, you know, Woodrow Wilson's phrase, safe for democracy. So, so I think that this is a kind of a permanent problem that it's going to be hard to get away from.
You don't think we've learned this lesson, that there will be another Afghanistan somewhere down the line, Vietnam, another Afghanistan.
I mean, it's hard. So again, as a historian, Chris may have a better answer than I do, but it's hard to think of how that dynamic is going to change. Because I don't think we're going to go back to let's conquer countries in order to
take their land.
I don't think so either. And I think the American public certainly wants to think, and I think policymakers too want to regard the United States as fighting for something higher, ideals, for values that are true values that need to be defended in the world. I don't think there's any question that people are supportive of that vision in general terms. But they're not so supportive of long and protracted wars.
Yeah, right. That's true.
And there are – I think there really are significant questions to be answered about how we allow these missions to sort of drift and to morph.
Mission creep, right?
Yeah, into something more than it originally was. And so I do think there's – the planners in the Pentagon, in the State Department, and all across Washington, D.C., on both the Republican and Democratic side, have to confront these questions of how the United States uses its power in the world. I think everyone wants to use it in positive ways to make the world a better place, but you know, what that means on the ground in places where there is no structure. We have not proven ourselves to be very effective in building democracy from scratch in places where it hasn't been before. That certainly doesn't mean we should ignore the rights of people in Afghanistan, but policymakers also have to grapple with the fact that the public's will for staying in those places doesn't last forever. We were there for 20 years.
And let's just, if we could close, before we run out of time, on the idea of what this is going to mean for President Biden domestically, politically. So he still has a big agenda in front of him. They're still trying to get the infrastructure bill passed there. He still has a whole big budget bill with lots of different priorities that he'd like to see implemented. We talked previously about him wanting to, you know, have a new deal, new deal kind of idea for America, build back better. Is he going to be able to do that now that he's got this big loss hanging around his neck?
I think the biggest hit that he's taking is not likely to be a public opinion hit because, again, most Americans aren't – foreign policy isn't the thing that drives public opinion in most cases. It is a hit to the perception that they're very good at their jobs.
Yeah, right. That's right.
It's a hit to the perception of competence. And so I think he was seen as coming in on the heels of an administration that had lots of issues in terms of competence. And they have not proven themselves to be all that effective in this really big high stakes example.
Very visual. Right.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
And Grant Matson, just the final word. I mean, the last time we had a president get out of a war, he also left office in you know, for other reasons. Nixon, we're talking about, right? So he didn't deal with the political consequences of that choice. Do we have any models for this?
So presidents live in fear of being the president to lose a war, right? And I mean, in some ways, George W. Bush, right? Even though we could say on at least in 2008. He was, you know, the wars had been successes in Iraq and Afghanistan. At least in some ways you can make that claim. The perception that they were failures certainly, tarnished his reputation and so on. And I think
certainly
that
in Iraq.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Exactly. And so I think there's that potential. But I think Chris actually got it right that that the bigger issue is it sort of punctures the image of competence, you know. And so it's not so much just that the Taliban has swept back to power in Afghanistan. It's the very visual, very rapid way in which it's happened that, as Biden himself had to admit, caught him off guard. And I think that admission is probably as troubling for his future as anything we saw.
Grant Matson is a professor of history at Brigham Young University. Thanks for being with us. It's been good having you.
Hey, thank you.
And Chris Karpowitz is a professor of political science, co-director of the Center for the Study of Elections and Democracy at Brigham Young University. Chris, it's been great having you as well.
Always great to be here, Julie. Thanks.
This is Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. Coming up in about 15 minutes, how to be an ally of a person who is in the minority at your organization. Just ahead, the majority of criminal cases in America end with a guilty plea, not a jury trial. Even innocent people will sometimes plead guilty. Why would they do that? I'm Julie Rose. Thanks for tuning into Top of Mind today. Despite what you've seen on television, most criminal cases do not go to trial. More than 95% get resolved by the person pleading guilty and accepting whatever punishment has been offered by the prosecutor. Even people who are innocent of a crime will sometimes plead guilty. Now, this has been a long-term trend in the U.S. justice system, and it appears to have accelerated during the pandemic. Mikkel Wilford wrote about her research on this topic recently for The Conversation website. She's a professor at the University of Massachusetts Lowell. She's with us now. Professor Wilford, hi there.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Why would an innocent person ever plead guilty and accept a plea deal?
Right. I mean, that's a fantastic question. It really gets to the crux of what I've spent the last decade researching, and I frankly still don't know all the answers to that question. But there are a number of potential reasons that could influence a factually innocent person to still accept a plea offer, even admitting guilt for a crime that they didn't actually commit. And I think one of the biggest reasons is because of the discounts that they can receive in exchange for a guilty plea. And some people have even gone so far as to say that they aren't actually discounts, but they're actually penalties that they get for potentially not pleading guilty and actually exercising their right to trial.
What do you mean discounts?
So essentially, right, most guilty pleas are the result of what are called plea bargains or plea negotiations. And what happens is a prosecutor will essentially say, look, if you agree to waive your right to trial, then I will discount your sentence or I'll drop some of the charges that I might otherwise bring up against you if you were to reject this plea offer and go to trial and make me go to the work of convicting you through by a jury. So these discounts or these penalties can be just overwhelming in magnitude, I think, even to an innocent person. So to give a couple of particularly egregious examples, there was a case of this person named Weldon Angelos, who was accused of selling marijuana while in possession of a gun on three occasions. And gun possession during a drug trafficking crime is a crime that carries a mandatory minimum sentence. So for the first count, you get 5 years mandatory minimum incarceration. For each subsequent charge, you get 25 years. And the prosecutor threatened to charge him with all three counts of this mandatory minimum crime if he went to trial. But if he was willing to forego his right to trial, he actually offered him a plea for 15 years in prison. So you're looking at a 40-year difference simply for choosing to reject a plea offer and exercising your constitutional right to a trial. And in this case, Angelos, frankly, surprisingly refused the plea offer, went to trial, and was ultimately convicted. And the judge in his case was very reluctant to impose the sentence that by law he was absolutely obligated to impose. Hmm. So the judge in his case was forced to impose a sentence that he did not want to. That's sort of, these are some of the weird things that are resulting from this over-reliance on pleas.
Okay, so, well, okay, let's pause then and talk about that. This over-reliance on pleas. Is this a new, at what point and what is it that shifted so that 95% of criminal charges are resolved through a plea deal rather than going to a trial of, you know, a jury trial in front of a jury of your peers, right? Which is the constitutional right that we all have.
Right.
What is it that shifted this? Why do so many of these cases go end in a plea deal instead?
Yes. So unfortunately, we can't know for certain because, of course, there's a lot of different things that have changed that have kind of coincided with this trend. But a lot of legal scholars believe that it really coincided around the late 1980s is where you started to see the proportion of cases that were disposed by trial start to decrease. So for a long time, the proportion of cases that were decided by trials was around 80%. And that started changing in the late 1980s. In the late 1980s, you start to see a drop in the proportion of jury trials and an increase in the proportion of cases decided by guilty pleas. And also in the late 1980s, you had a number of jurisdictions pass these sort of tough on crime laws, right? Where you had three strikes penalties, you had an increase in the number of crimes that carried mandatory minimum sentences, mm-hmm. you had the war on drugs, right? So essentially you had a number of changes with regard to the punitiveness of sentences that arguably made it much easier for prosecutors to sort of sweeten the deal with regard to these charges determining the sentences that defendants would receive.
Which, and also so, those mandatory minimums and increased penalties mm-hmm. also made it riskier to go to trial because you could end up in a situation like Weldon Angelos, which you just described, where, you know, if you roll the dice and you know, let a jury decide, then, you know, there's because of these mandatory minimums, there's a lot more risk that you could end up facing a much higher sentence.
Absolutely. Much riskier to go to trial. Absolutely.
Okay. Is there anything else? Any other reason why prosecutors would be, I guess, and the court system in general would be sort of trying to funnel as many people as possible toward plea deals instead of a jury trial?
You know, I mean, I also think it has to do with there's been a debate that we've sort of overcriminalized a lot of behaviors in this country. And in order to process the number of cases as a result of the fact that, you know, more things are now against the law, prosecutors are feeling the pressure to get cases still disposed of efficiently or as efficiently as possible. So in order to handle their caseloads, they're almost forced to try to make sure that a majority of these cases are resolved via plea negotiations rather than a trial, which of course is much more work, right? Seeing a case through trial can be months and months and months of work, whereas a guilty plea can end a case in days.
Is it though, always risky? So let's think about that innocent person again. Someone who is says they're innocent, believes they're innocent, is innocent. But the prosecutor mm-hmm. apparently thinks that they're guilty. And the prosecutor, you know, may be able to make a case that you're guilty, even if you're innocent. Talk me through what that decision process is like then for an innocent person. What are they taking into account besides just the possibility that some crazy thing will happen and this prosecutor will manage to convict them and convince a jury that they did the thing? What else is there that might, kind of nudge an innocent person to just be like, OK, fine, I didn't do it, but I'm just going to plead guilty.
Right. So in addition to the penalties that these defendants could face, you know, as a consequence of rejecting a plea and going to trial and getting a much more punitive sentence, you also have cases wherein, and this is one of the issues that we talked about that was exacerbated by the pandemic. So you have a number of cases wherein defendants have to be incarcerated to await trial. This is called pretrial detention. So for a defendant who's currently incarcerated and is being told that it could be weeks, it could be months until they have a trial, and then a prosecutor stops by and asks and offers them a sentence for, we call it a time served sentence. So essentially what it means is if you agree to plead guilty, you waive your right to trial, you'll walk today, you'll be released. That sort of offer can be extremely attractive, even to an innocent person who's currently sitting in prison. They're trying to be patient, but, you know, they might have kids at home. They might have a job they're hoping to keep, right? Just imagine if you were suddenly told you had to spend an indefinite amount of time in prison, the number of things that that would affect for you. And then think about how enticing it would be to get an offer, even if you're innocent, even if you know you're innocent, even if you're confident you could prove it to a jury, which frankly, it's hard to be confident of that because juries can really be a mixed bag. Even in that situation, just having to wait and wait and wait in prison can be its own huge burden on an innocent person who's offered a plea for time served.
Why would somebody not have the chance to post bail and wait for their trial outside of prison?
Mm-hmm. So that's a great question. So in some jurisdictions, there are actually laws where if you have a previous conviction, you have to be held. You have to be detained if you're suspected of committing another crime. In some instances, they'll provide a bail amount, but it's just unattainable for a number of people, you know. So perhaps the judge thought the bail amount was reasonable, but for the particular defendant, because they just don't have a lot of money that's liquid that's available for them, they can't afford that bail amount and they have to await their trial in prisons. So there can be a number of reasons. In fact, there was a case that actually got a lot of publicity a few years ago, the case of Khalif Browder, who was only 16 when he was suspected of stealing a backpack. And again, this was a case where he had been previously convicted of another crime. So he was automatically sent to pretrial detention simply because he was accused of committing another crime. And he ended up spending 3 years on Rikers Island awaiting his trial before the charges were ultimately dismissed. And so, sadly, after being released, he ended up committing suicide, likely because of the traumas that he experienced while on Rikers Island.
Yeah, really tragic. So if you are in terms of the profile of the individual who is most likely to be in a situation where they're innocent but pleading guilty in order to accept a deal, it sounds like you'll have a previous conviction. Is one way that make that more likely for you, or you're low income or don't have access to resources to pay to post bail. Is there anything else, any other demographic information that would make an individual more at risk for pleading guilty or feeling like they have no choice but to plead guilty, even if they're innocent?
You know, it's a very, very complex decision, and it's really hard to say. And another reason it's frankly hard to say is because research on plea decision making is actually still relatively new. I mean, we're still doing new studies. We're still trying to answer these great questions that you're asking. So as far as, you know, whether there are demographics that might predispose one to falsely plead guilty, I think it's still too soon to answer that question because there have been very few studies looking at it. But there is maybe some preliminary evidence suggesting that juvenile defendants are at a higher risk of pleading guilty falsely to crimes simply because they're more likely to sort of acquiesce to authority figures. And if a prosecutor is telling them that pleading guilty is in their best interest, they might be more likely to just do that. But as far as other risk factors, the research is still somewhat in its infancy.
And so what if somebody you know, if a prosecutor comes to you and says, look, I'll let you out for time served and I won't make you go to, you know, go to trial, but you have to plead guilty. What is the consequence of that? I mean, what's the harm in that if you, the innocent person, at least you're, you know, you're getting out, right? What consequence? Mm-hmm. Where is the harm there?
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, of course, there are a number of so the question you're really getting at is what is the difference between sort of these direct consequences that we associate with a criminal conviction, which is time incarcerated, but then what are some of the more collateral consequences from being convicted of a crime?
Right.
And frankly, there are hundreds, sometimes thousands of collateral consequences from being convicted of a crime. So yes, you might get to leave prison, but you might be put on probation, and probation can come with a number of onerous subconsequences. So for instance, you might have to meet with a probation officer regularly. You'll likely have to pay probation fees. If you can't afford the probation fees, you could end up back in prison, which happens to a number of these individuals. There's also, you know, limitations on your right to own guns. There are limitations on your ability to get federal assistance to go to school. There might be limits on the number of jobs you can get, whether you can work in healthcare, whether you can join the military. There are a number of collateral consequences that can result from a conviction. Even if you leave prison, there will still be a number of consequences that result from that plea conviction.
And what changed during the pandemic, do we think?
Yes. So the pandemic really exacerbated a lot of these issues with pretrial detention because, of course, prisons, as you can imagine, became just hotspots for outbreaks of COVID-19, right? You don't really have the ability to social distance in prison environments. And of course, you know, the access to masks and other medical equipment to try and prevent infection is limited in prison environment. And essentially what happened, of course, is the number of organizations did try to sort of point this out to policymakers and say, perhaps we should be limiting our use of things like pretrial detention to try and reduce the prison population so that we don't have these outbreaks. But unfortunately, there's very little evidence to support the idea that that actually had any impact. Like it appears that the prison population still remained relatively stable during the pandemic. And as a result, there were many outbreaks in prisons. So I believe around 400,000 prisoners tested positive for COVID. We know that around 3,000 prisoners/correctional officers died of COVID, likely contracted from their contact in the prison. So essentially what the pandemic did was it increased the cost of potentially having to await trial while incarcerated, making it even more likely that a person who's in pretrial detention, who's offered a plea for time served, whether they're innocent or guilty, will just say, fine, I'll sign on the dotted line, just get me out of here.
Yeah. Professor Wilford, if we don't know for sure how many innocent people are taking plea deals, because we don't, all we know is their word, you know, nobody's mm-hmm. proven that they're innocent. So it's difficult to know for sure how often this happens. Is there anything that we could do? Is there any way that the system could be changed to make it less likely that an innocent person would plead guilty?
Sure. So I do want to say first that although we can't know, obviously, you know, there are some studies that rely on self-reports where people say they were innocent, and you're absolutely right. We can't know that that's actually true. But there have actually been a number of cases documented by an organization called the National Registry of Exonerations. So they record proven wrongful convictions and have found about 20% of their cases have involved guilty pleas. Mm. So there are at least a few documented examples of people who pled guilty falsely to crimes for which they were convicted. But with regard to limiting the number of times that this might happen, there are a number of different things we could do. So right now, there are no limitations on getting back to that penalty that we discussed. So the penalty that a defendant could face for rejecting a plea offer. So you heard the case of Weldon Angelos, where he was offered a plea sentence of 15 years and then ultimately was sentenced to 55 years. So you're looking at a 40-year increase from guilty plea to trial sentence. Mm. So if we could pass a reform that somehow tied the sentence one would face at trial to the sentence one's offered during plea negotiations, that would theoretically have a positive effect with regard to making pleas less attractive and to reducing that pressure to plead guilty.
Right.
And then, of course, we could also reduce the use of pretrial detention. So we could try and tie bail amounts, you know, whatever bail is set at, make sure it's actually tied to the type of money that the defendant has available to them, right? So not set bail at $1,000, assuming, oh, everyone has access to $1,000, when in fact, that's just not the case, right? So being aware of the defendant's own financial limitations and trying to set bail at a reasonable rate, I think would also have a significant impact on reducing the number of pretrial detention, number of people incarcerated in pretrial detention, thereby also reducing the number of people feeling that pressure to plead guilty, regardless of whether they're actually innocent or guilty.
Miko Wilford is a professor of psychology at the University of Massachusetts Lowell. She studies plea deals and the decisions that get made in the justice system with regard to pleading guilty. Thank you very much for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
This is Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. Coming up next on Top of Mind, what allyship looks like in the workplace and how to know if you're doing it right. Great to have you with us today for Top of Mind. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Julie Rose. Allyship is a word we have heard a lot more about in recent years. When you're part of a majority, say you're a man in a male-dominated industry, what is the best way to support your female colleagues who may face sexism or discrimination? Or if you're a white person in a predominantly white organization, how can you best support the needs of those who are not white in your organization? Western Washington University Management and Psychology Professor Meg Warren studies allyship, and she says small actions matter more than people might think. Professor Warren, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me here.
Describe an act of allyship in a real-world setting.
Okay, so one of the most common forms of allyship is when you see something, you witness some form of microaggression or discrimination, you step up and confront and say, this is not okay. So that sort of a confrontation is the most popular way in which allyship occurs in organizations and outside of it.
Okay. And so in the studies that you've done, and most recently you've been looking at women working in male-dominated fields. So it's a male colleague who does the stepping up. What would that be like to kind of publicly call somebody out in the middle of a staff meeting? But how would it look most often, would you say?
Yes, most often you do have someone who has relative privilege in that context. That is when allyship is most often seen. So essentially they have privilege because they are part of a social group. So like men who tend to be heard more often, who seem to be more visible, who when they achieve something, their achievements are better celebrated. So those sorts of folks are able to step up and say something and call out a transgression or a microaggression. So that's usually how it occurs.
Okay. What leads a man to be an ally in a situation like that?
So what we find, the first thing is that they need to recognize that something that's happening here is not appropriate, that let's say men in a male-dominated organization notice that something is sexist. A person is saying something that's sexist or using sexist humor or in some form hurting the way women are perceived or a particular woman is being treated. And so that's the first step, being sensitive to what's happening and then identifying what's the right thing to do. And usually what we see is, like I mentioned, this confrontation. But of course, what my research shows is confrontation is not the only way to step up and be an ally. There are a host of other strategies that can be used.
What are those other strategies? What would be another way to be an ally?
Yeah, so some of my most recent work shows that a very useful strategy that is much lower risk, because confrontation, of course, is going to involve some kind of discomfort, both on the part of the one who is doing the confronting as well as the one who ends up being confronted. An alternative strategy is to highlight the strengths of the person who is being discriminated against. Talking about their achievements, talking about how well the kind of strengths they bring and how well they do to counteract the kind of biases that are being used against in this context, her.
Okay. You mentioned that that a man may become an ally when he recognizes that there's discrimination taking place, but then he has to make a decision to do something about it. What is that decision like? And what kinds of things do you see men in this case, taking into consideration when they decide whether or not to be a more, you know, to be an engaged ally.
Yeah, absolutely. This is especially a time where there is so much polarization. So the question that you ask is so important, and the answer to it has been changing. In the past, we assumed that when people didn't step up and say something, it's because they didn't care. And more and more now, we see that folks increasingly care about microaggressions. They care about discrimination. They want to stop it, but they're not always sure how best to do it. So the kind of questions that we see in our most recent research around barriers to allyship is one, feeling whether it is it even my place? Questioning whether it's their place to step up and say something. You know, am I going to offend the person who has been the target of the victimization, the discrimination, and whether they would prefer to do it on their own? That's one issue that comes up. Another is, am I going to say the right thing? Am I going to say something that might end up burning some relationships and bridges between people? Am I going to say something that ends up doing more harm than good? So these are the kind of questions that you see come up more often now.
What is the answer to that? Is it my place? How, I guess this would be in any instance, how important is it to like get clearance from the person you want to be an ally to before you do the thing, right? And that sort of takes away some of the spontaneity because it, you know, something may come up in the moment, you know, and if you like, hey, can we have a sidebar? You know, do you want me to help with this or do you want to handle it? Like, what's the best way to go about that?
Yeah, so checking in is a good strategy. I think what is also important is to identify whether this is urgent, and so you really need to step up right now. If someone did say something right now, things could take a really bad turn. If you realize that that is the situation, then leaning towards saying something rather than not may be more important. If there is a way to table this conversation, because this is going to be snowball into a much bigger issue, or let's say this is a conversation about a policy that is going to need more deliberation. So, you know, all allyship does not have to be only sexist specific instances that are, you know, hot. Mm-hmm. They might be something that requires more deliberation. In any of those kinds of situations, it does make sense to step back, check in, see if you need to rally more information, gather information, rally troops. What do you need to do to be more effective? So they're both the hot instances and the more cooler, deliberate instances, and being able to identify what is the right, best step for the best long-term solutions.
You have interviewed peers, a woman and a man, both working in the same work environment. One or the other of them sees the man as an ally. How often is there a mismatch where, you know, a man in a work environment might think he's an ally and the woman that he's being an ally for kind of doesn't see it that way?
Yeah, this happens much more often than we like. And I think part of the issue here, this mismatch between men seeing themselves as allies versus women, is that men may take some time to think about what they want to be, what they stand for, who they want to be, what they want to do, and all of that homework. You know, they might be listening to radio shows like this. They may be listening to podcasts. They may do their own homework, read articles, do a bunch of things that make them feel like they are allies. But unless that actually translates into visible behaviors that women can see, women have no idea that they intend to be allies. So that can be a really easy reason for that mismatch.
Does it matter if a woman knows that she has allies in an organization?
Yes, absolutely. It matters because it makes her less isolated in her fight for justice. A lot of times women end up having to pursue justice, having to combat discrimination by themselves, and not knowing that, you do have support, even if it's silent support, even if people are not ready to say something publicly, but they are willing to support you in private. If you don't even know that, you don't know how alone you are. And the best version is when people are publicly willing to support you and are able to stand up with you.
So in terms of,
you can feel empowered.
In terms of small things that can make a difference, even just acknowledging to an individual, you know, I want to be an ally. I am supportive of your cause. I want to see you have opportunities. I disagree with some of this treatment. How can I be helpful? And sort of, you know, stepping into that space, that in and of itself, even if you're not, you know, out there with your sword doing battle on the front lines every day in your workplace.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Even little gestures that say, I am here. I want to listen. I want to be there. Let me know how I can help. There may be some things that I can do right away. I need some preparation. Maybe I need training. Maybe I need more support myself. But I want to be on this journey and I want to support you. That is a very important thing to share.
What's something organizations can do to encourage allyship?
One thing that we see that dampens allyship is when people are worried that they cannot, that they're not safe to make mistakes. And that goes back to the kind of psychological safety that an organization can create. So if people feel like I am going to be taken care of, if I make a mistake, I will be gently corrected, that I can receive the training that I need, I can receive opportunities to be an ally. All of those can be really, really powerful in people stepping up as allies. And those are all spaces in which organizations can really contribute, creating that community, creating that safety.
Meg Warren is a professor of management and psychology at Western Washington University. Thank you for your time today, Professor Warren.
Thank you.
Top of Mind is a production of BYU Radio. It's great having you along. Doulas have become quite common in childbirth. They're trained helpers or companions who support the mother through the process. Doulas are now becoming more common in the other big life passage we all go through, death. When and why might a person need a death doula? We spoke with a woman who quit her career as an accountant to become an end-of-life doula after a close friend died. Learn about her work right along with us on Top of Mind, wherever you get your podcasts. This is Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. First, Black farmers faced decades of discrimination trying to get loans and aid from the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Their complaints were ignored. So finally, in the late 90s, they sued the U.S. government. We'll hear how they won that lawsuit. Then, squirrels may seem kind of dumb, but they're actually genius when it comes to leaping. That's ahead on Top of Mind. Thanks for tuning in. An attorney friend once commented to Greg Francis that he, Greg, is the most successful civil rights attorney in America that nobody knows. That's because Greg Francis represented thousands of Black farmers and their descendants in settling the largest civil rights case in U.S. history. It's called Pigford versus Glickman, and it played out starting in the late 1990s. Black farmers accused the U.S. Department of Agriculture of systematically discriminating against them. The U.S. government didn't even try to deny it and instead settled with the farmers and then reopened the case to allow more Black farmers to receive total compensation of $1.25 billion. Attorney Greg Francis has written a book about the case, which is called Just Harvest, and he's with me now. Mr. Francis, welcome.
Good to be here, Julie. Thank you for having me.
So if Pigford is such a historic case, why wasn't it all over the front pages like it was Brown versus Board of Education, right? Or some other sort of seminal, iconic moment. Why don't more people know about it?
I think that more people don't know about it. It did not get as much national publicity or publicity, period, is because we're dealing with farmers and people who live out in very rural areas that were affected by this. And these, a lot of times, are the isolation that goes along with living in rural America and farming, I think, is not something that is necessarily of interest in general to a lot of the news media. The reality of it is, you know, these are the folks who put food on our table. But I think, you know, even myself, sometimes takes it for granted in terms of, you know, having food readily available. So we forget about that, almost that segment of the population.
What in your background or upbringing prepared you to care about Black farmers and to represent them in this case?
You know, Julie, I'm originally from Panama in Central America, and my family and my forefathers came from the islands around Panama in order to build a canal because, you know, many of the Americans who were going down there were not physically equipped to handle the weather down there. My grandparents, my great-grandparents, my grandparents instilled in me a sense of pride, a sense of what doing what's right. And, you know, and then just coming to America, facing a bunch of different obstacles, not necessarily speaking English very well at first, not necessarily having the best living conditions. I just always seemed to be, you know, the underdog, but that fueled me, that fueled the fire within me to seek justice.
When you came to America, where did you land? Where were you living?
And when we came to America in Orlando, we moved to Orlando, the west side of Orlando. Disney was being completed, and Orlando was a much smaller town than it is now currently.
And as a kid, did you, as a young Black man in America, did you aspire to be a lawyer and represent the underdog? How did that come to, you know, kind of flesh out to fruition for you?
Right. Yeah. The answer to that is never. Never thought about being a lawyer or any of that. I'm only the second person in my family to go to college. And we thought that college was kind of the end all be all. There was never any thoughts of graduate school or any of that. But, you know, as divine intervention would have it, as I'm graduating from undergrad with a degree in criminal justice, I realized I didn't aspire to be a police officer either. And I tried to figure out what I was going to do. And as I was walking by the bookstore, I said, you know what, I'm going to go to law school. And I went in, bought a workbook and studied for the LSAT, took the LSAT 40 days later. And, you know, then here I am in law school. And it seemed like I was prepared for it the entire time because I saw, you know, growing up, how many of my peers were not given necessarily a fair shake and, you know, but they had no one to speak for them. So when given that opportunity in law school, you know, it just seemed like a natural fit.
So, Greg Francis, you were, relatively early in your career compared to a number of the other attorneys who would ultimately get involved in the Pigford lawsuits representing Black farmers. Can you recall the first story of a Black farmer and what they'd experienced that with the U.S. Department of Agriculture that sort of galvanized you into thinking like, okay, this is something I need to work for. And also, you know, I know I'm young, but I think I can do this, right? Tell me what that moment was for you.
You know, Julie, I think the initial conversations I had were with Mike Espy, who was the former Secretary of Agriculture, who really is who put the steps in place and kind of got the justice that was dispensed in this case going. And Mike would tell me, I was working in Mississippi at the time, back and forth between Orlando and Mississippi. And Mike would tell me about the discrimination that Black farmers had experienced and his experiences while he was at the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
And let's just clarify. So Mike Espy is himself African-American, the first Black Secretary of Agriculture, I believe, ever in the United States. And served under, it was Clinton, right? So he was
Clinton, yes, the Clinton administration, right.
Okay.
Correct.
All right. So this is after he's out of office and he's working to organize. And and so go ahead and pick up the story.
Well, what happened initially is when Mike became the Secretary of Agriculture, on his very first day, he asked a staffer to go down and pull out the notes that his dad had written. His dad was a for the USDA and had written numerous boxes of complaints, either written or received boxes of complaints that were forwarded on that were never addressed. And Mike, on his very first day there, had those boxes brought up, began looking through that and decided that, in fact, he was going to ensure that there was justice for African-American farmers here in America. You know, shortly thereafter, he was indicted for something unrelated, which he was ultimately found innocent of every charge. However, he had put in place to compensate Timothy Pigford, as a matter of fact. He had put in place to compensate Timothy Pigford for being discriminated against and being denied the loans in order to operate his farm. And when he resigned from office under indictment, that's where Secretary Glickman came on board. And therefore, that's what resulted in, you know, Pigford versus Glickman, because Secretary Glickman reversed the decisions that Mike Espy had made to compensate Timothy Pigford.
Okay, compensate for what? Maybe, tell us a little bit about Timothy Pigford and what he had experienced.
Sure. What Timothy Pigford experienced and what, you know, tens of thousands of African-American farmers experienced was just a systemic denial of benefits that were being provided to other farmers in their local communities. You know, America, right after the Civil War, recognized that in order to have a strong sovereignty, a nation that would be strong and viable, that one of the things that was important is that we could feed the citizens of America. So they created the U.S. Department of Agriculture, which would go in and work with farmers and in many ways support farmers in their efforts in order to ensure that there was food for, you know, all Americans. So the USDA would provide and still does provide different grant programs, loan programs that ultimately would assist a farmer, whether it's for the acquisition of additional land, whether it's for the, you know, pesticides, the supplies, the seeds or whatnot. The U.S. Department of Agriculture acted kind of as a lending institution for farmers. However, you know, a white farmer would go in and his farm and his loan would be processed within 30 days and he would be receiving money. And, you know, the average for a black farmer was probably more about like 9 months it would take before they had a decision on their loan. And most times, you know, they were denied. And those are some of the more subtle discrimination that black farmers experienced. You know, I have stories of farmers who came and spoke with me or that I spoke to during this case where their applications would simply be thrown away in their face, or they would be told, you know, because of your race, you're not going to get any money. And it was that blatant at times, you know, in different places in America.
Told that by whom? Was this official U.S. Department of Agriculture policy? Like, at what point? Where was this discrimination taking place?
Yeah, no, it was not. This was not. And well, let me say it this way. There was a system that was put in place. However, any system that is put in place, as any government, you know, any bureaucracy has to have kind of a system of how this is done, but it has to be implemented. So this discrimination would be occurring in the local extension offices, many times by people who are not, in fact, farmers, but just were government employees that went to work there.
Usually so white? Usually white?
Yes.
Usually the time.
White, yes. Okay. Usually white. And what you have to understand, too, is there was a change of heart, you know, after the Emancipation. I mean, I'm sorry. There was a change of legislation, you know, with the Emancipation Proclamation, freeing the slaves and whatnot. However, there wasn't a change of heart. Those same folks who had once enslaved, you know, the blacks were now put in charge of whether they were going to grant, you know, funds or equipment to these black farmers. So while the system itself may not have been discriminatory, the actual implementation of it was, you know, very discriminatory and very biased against black farmers.
And only in the South was this happening?
Well, this was happening all over. The vast majority of the farms were in the South, Mississippi, Alabama, North and South Carolina, Georgia, some in Texas, as far north as probably Virginia. So it was happening all over. And again, because it wasn't necessarily a USDA policy, I just found how interesting it was that many of the farmers would be experiencing the same type of things in totally different parts of the country. You know, someone in Georgia experienced the same exact thing that someone in Oklahoma had experienced in terms of being denied. So what that said to me is that there was not any attention paid to who, in fact, was implementing these programs, how it was being implemented, and the disparate impact that it was having on Black farmers.
And what period of time are we talking about where this discrimination is taking place against Black farmers?
Specifically, because of a lot of legal terms, statute of limitations, the Pigford case actually involved discrimination between 1981 and 1996. However, if you know, the USDA has done many studies themselves on this and has determined that this discrimination went on long before 1981. However, because of statute of limitations, we couldn't go back that far.
1981, though, that's decades after the Civil Rights Act is passed. You're saying that that Black farmers would go into a USDA extension office asking for a loan and be mistreated in that way, or just be more sort of subtly given the runaround, even into the 90s?
Julie, this varied from, as like I said, as subtle as, very processed loan very slowly. And if you know about farming, timing is everything. So the loans had to be timely as well. So it could be as subtle as dragging it out. But there were also stories of, look, I went in and I gave my application and they threw it in the garbage in front of me, or they wouldn't give me an application, or they would give them the runaround and say, look, this is the wrong extension office. You need to go to the office in the next county over. So it just varied in terms of exactly how the discrimination happened, but it was, still very prevalent.
And Black farmers were complaining about this. They were filing formal complaints with the U.S. Department of Agriculture, which I guess just didn't get followed up on or acted on in any organized way. Is that right?
Right. And that was kind of the vehicle that we use in order to get compensation and to go back as far as 1981 to 1996 is that, these farmers were complaining and sending letters to the USDA, and there was really no one in place in the USDA at the time. President Reagan had done away with all of the offices of civil rights that would normally address this and, at least investigate the claims. So because there was no office or no entity which the Black farmers could really complain to and get, either an investigation or get results or at least have their grievances heard, we were able to, extend that statute of limitations and bring the lawsuit.
I'm speaking with Greg Francis, who was lead counsel representing Black farmers in one of the cases related to discrimination from the U.S. Department of Agriculture, which settled for an historic amount, the largest civil rights case against the U.S. government in U.S. history, really. Greg Francis has a book called Just Harvest, which tells the story of this case. So tell us then about Timothy Pigford specifically. What did he say was done to him, and how did he ultimately become the name on this lawsuit, Pigford versus Glickman?
Mr. Pigford was a farmer in North Carolina who had went in for operating loans. He'd been well educated and had completed the claims for or the loan application. However, he was denied. He consistently asked for the reasons for his denial, was never really given a reason. And as I said before, when Mike Espy became the Secretary of Agriculture, he was determined to fix this from within the USDA and launched an investigation and so really sought out farmers who were, in fact, he knew were qualified, well-qualified, and who had been denied. And Mr. Pigford happened to be the first farmer that after investigation by the USDA when Mike Espy was the secretary, was going to be granted monetary relief for the discrimination that he had suffered. However, Mr. Espy left office before the end of his term. Secretary Glickman came in and reversed the decision of Mike Espy to grant relief for Mr. Pigford. And that's what resulted, and that's how Mr. Pickford became kind of the face and the name of this case.
What ultimately happened? So he was denied a loan to what? To purchase his home? His farm?
He was denied loans to purchase his home as well as for operating loans for the farm itself, which, you know, have been, you know, probably pretty routinely granted for other farmers all across America. So as a result of this, his farm failed and he ultimately was evicted because of the failures or the lack of funds that were provided to him from the USDA.
Yeah. And you know, I mean, he's in North Carolina. You write about how there were years of drought. There was a major hurricane during this period.
Right.
You know, and that's exactly what farmers would turn to the USDA for, to sort of stay afloat during these, you know, really difficult ups and downs with Mother Nature. And he just didn't have any lifeline to sort of weather those storms, and ultimately was evicted, you said.
Right. Ultimately was evicted. And then, like I said earlier, you know, the USDA being formed by the U.S. government was really in an attempt to do exactly and address exactly what you just mentioned there. Anytime there was droughts or any type of weather conditions, any type of disease for the crops or anything like that, the USDA was supposed to be there to prop up farmers, to assist them through the hard period so that we could have a consistent flow of food for, you know, everyone in America.
If Black farmers were consistently not getting that support, how were there any Black farmers succeeding in the country, you know, by the 90s?
Well, if you look at it like this, Julie, and, you know, in about 1920, about 15% of all farmers were African American. And they provided about 30% of the food that was being consumed in America. You know, what's interesting about that, that sounds like a pretty good return, 15% providing 30% of the food. So that showed that, you know, the farmers were proficient in doing their jobs or in running these farms. However, after 1920, between 1920 and when this case came about, and probably 1981 or really in the late 90s when it came about, we went from, you know, almost 960,000 Black farmers to less than 40,000 Black farmers.
Wow.
So it was a slow attrition of Black farmers where, you know, they would get in the business, or the farm would be handed down from one generation to the next. And ultimately, you know, as farmers have, there's going to be an issue. There's going to be bad weather. There's going to be a drought, that type of thing. And most times the Black farmers were not able to survive that.
And farming in America is generally a difficult thing. White farmers have not seen a comparable rate of decline over the last century.
No, there has been. There certainly, as a whole, there has been a decline in the number of farmers. Now we have these big agri farms, and it's big business now. However, the attrition that happened to African American farmers was a greater attrition than it was to, you know, the white farming community.
Speaking with Greg Francis, who is an attorney in Florida with the law firm Osborne and Francis, he was lead counsel on the historic Black farmers case, which resulted in the largest settlement of a civil rights case against the U.S. government in American history. His new book about that case is called Just Harvest. We have to take a very quick break here on Top of Mind. When we come back, we'll talk about how the case played out when Timothy Pickford became the name on the lawsuit, Pickford versus Glickman, in the late 90s. It wouldn't be until really 2010 and beyond that the large majority of Black farmers began to see compensation from the U.S. Department of Agriculture. I'm Julie Rose. We'll be right back. Thanks for tuning in to Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. It's good to have you with us. I'm speaking with Greg Francis. He is a personal injury attorney in Florida with Osborne and Francis, and he's author of the new book, Just Harvest, the story of how black farmers won the largest civil rights case against the U.S. government. Greg Francis was one of the attorneys that represented black farmers in that case. Okay, so you talked to us about Timothy Pigford, who was about to get compensated. That fell through. He was evicted. He becomes the named plaintiff in a class action lawsuit against the U.S. Department of Agriculture called Pigford versus Glickman. This is in the late 90s. And how does the U.S. government respond to that lawsuit?
You know, based on internal studies that had been done in the USDA, there really wasn't much of a defense put up by the Department of Agriculture once the lawsuit was filed. The evidence, you know, they knew that, you know, in examining the evidence and looking at the actual impact of or the distribution of where the funds went, that there was no defense to the treatment, and there was no really way to describe or explain why black farmers had received such a small percentage of the operating loans out. So they decided that this is a case that they would settle. You know, initially it was thought to be, you know, just less than 10,000 black farmers involved. But as news of this case, the lawsuit got out, that number swelled to, you know, a little over 12,000 farmers. But in reality, the impact of this had been on a much larger scale, a much larger portion of the black farming community.
But a lot of those farmers probably hadn't even filed complaints, because if you know that you're just going to get consistently ignored, at a certain point, you're just going to stop complaining to the organization that's, you know.
Well, Julie, you know what? You mentioned exactly the next point I was going to go to. So even once the case was settled, or there was a, you know, notice that the case would be settled, and in fact, these farmers would be able to have their cases heard on the merits and determine whether they had experienced the discrimination or not. The reality is that most black farmers did not file a claims form. And that's just because they believed they had been denied for so many years by this very government. It was hard for them to believe that, in fact, the government was going to now compensate them for the wrongs that they had experienced. So the vast majority of the farmers who had been affected, you know, probably close to 40,000 black farmers or their descendants, did not participate, did not file a claims form within the time frame, and therefore had not had their cases heard on the merits. And that's what really led to Pigford too, where the case was reopened.
Right. Okay. So the problem with that, first, the U.S. government doesn't really mount a defense. It never goes to trial. They decide to settle it. Right. But there's a deadline for when black farmers need to step forward, make their case in order to get compensation. And what would that compensation have been like for those farmers? How much money are we talking about?
It was ultimately negotiated and decided that each farmer who was able to prove that they were discriminated against would get a payment of $50,000 for damages for the years of discrimination, and an additional $12,500 to pay the taxes on it to ensure that, you know, actual $50,000 went in their pocket. Mm. But that was really the compensation. There was supposed to be, in addition to that, an evaluation of whether the farmers would also be eligible for debt relief. The reality is very few farmers received any debt relief. And I think that is something that actually has come up and is being dealt with now by the current USDA administration.
Hmm. So that first round, then, as you were saying, that there was a problem with the initial settlement timeframe, in that they're just very few black farmers actually stepped forward and were able to. And then a lot of claims were filed too late, right? Because the window.
Yeah, but the vast majority of the claims were too late. And, you know, when you consider, you put all the factors together. A, here's a group that had been discriminated against for so long, and why were they now going to believe that they're going to be compensated? But also, although you and I are talking over this medium, we have satellite radio and Sirius, and and different mediums and social media and whatnot. Rural America, that's not so. You know, there is a problem with broadband and therefore the connectivity of these farmers, not only to other Black farmers, but just, you know, the larger populations in some of the metropolitan areas, period. So I can recall being on the trail talking to, it was actually the first meeting that I went to and Mike Espy and I hosted, and the line was out the door and around the corner. And quite frankly, we didn't bring enough materials to sign up all the folks who were there. So I mentioned to one of the farmers, you know, please give me your email address. And I'll, you know, I'll email it to you. And her response was, baby, we don't even have cable in where I live. So we definitely don't have any internet. Mm-hmm. So there was really a connectivity issue in addition to just the feeling of, look, we've always been discriminated against. Why are they going to do anything different? So there were almost 60,000 claims that were filed late beyond the 6-month time frame that the judge put in place to have, you know, all the claims forms heard. So they could have an idea of how many farmers they were talking about potentially.
So that's when the U.S. Department of Agriculture agrees to reopen the case. It becomes known as Pigford 2. And that's when you get involved, right?
Right, right. After the initial time frame had passed and in fact, all those farmers had been denied, there was constant advocacy by people like John Boyd, Gary Grant, farmers, you know, other farm advocates that, in fact, this was not justice because the vast majority of the farmers' cases had not been heard. So it took several years, but in the 2008 Farm Bill, there was some money set aside for readdressing the issues that the Black farmers had and whether, in fact, those who had been late were going to be able to have their cases heard. That really led to the beginning of, we filed suit once again, and that really led to, you know, ultimately the settlement in the second case.
And once again, it doesn't go to trial.
Right.
It's just a negotiated settlement. So what even was your job? What's the job of the lead counsel if you don't have to put a case together?
Well, I mean, obviously, we didn't get in the case thinking that it wasn't going to be a trial. We were prepared for that. However, with the vast amount of evidence that they had against them, you know, the government decided that, in fact, it was going to be probably more economically feasible for them to resolve the case. So my job then turned to making sure that the farmers, in fact, were notified and had the opportunity to have their cases heard and to file the claims form on a timely fashion. So understanding that there was not any money set aside to do any type of mass advertising on TV or anything like that. We were doing some mail pieces. I jumped in my car. I hired a media consultant. I jumped in my car and I drove around many small towns in Mississippi, Alabama, North and South Carolina, Oklahoma, holding press conferences with the local TV stations because, you know, I recognize that farmers don't get to watch TV all day. They're usually up before, you know, daylight. And when they come home, they come home in the evenings after a lot of the programming is done. But they do listen to the news or someone in the house listens to the news. So it was important for me to get, you know, kind of on the road and make sure that I had these press conferences in advance of any meetings that we were going to have to assist the farmers in filling out their claims forms. So that was probably part of it is the notification of the farmers. And then this was a huge effort to get, you know, ultimately we had, you know, about 35,000 farmers who filed claims. Less than 20,000 were successful, but it was a huge task to set up meetings in areas where there would be lawyers and paralegals available to assist the farmers in terms of, you know, filling out their claims form. So it was a huge coordinated effort in order to get those farmers, to get the claims forms filled out after the farms had been notified and ultimately get them adjudicated.
Mm. And the money was coming from an appropriation from Congress that President Obama signed in 2010, right?
Right, right, okay. Right. The initial appropriation in the farm bill was $50 million. Everyone knew that that was not going to be enough money to compensate the vast number of farmers that were out there who had not had their cases heard. So ultimately, again, it was a negotiated settlement between the group of lawyers that I was a part of and led, the U.S. Department of Agriculture and the U.S. Department of Justice actually got involved as well and negotiated what they thought would be, a sufficient amount of money to compensate those farmers.
A total then of $1.25 billion, a historically large amount of money for a situation like this. And for you and the other lawyers involved, were you going to get a cut of that? Like, what was the calculus for you in terms of the risks and the opportunities to get involved in a case like this?
This is initially when we got involved in the case, because I am a contingency lawyer, it was thought that, we could contract with our clients and, in fact, get the traditional 33 1/3 or 40% of the, of the recovery. But we knew that we couldn't get any type of recovery that was going to diminish or cause the farmers to get less than the farmers had gotten in the first case, of Pigford, of the $50,000. But ultimately, my group took the position that this, in fact, needed to be a class action and not an individual action where we had these individual contracts. All the lawyers were not happy about that when we took that position. However, I felt like that was the right thing to do. And ultimately, we left the percentage of what we would get in compensation up to the judge because it was a class action. And it was much, 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 much less than the 33 1/3 or the 40% that we would normally have received.
40% of $1.25 billion is a lot of money. So,
right.
Yeah.
Right. Right.
So ultimately, how many farmers then were able to get compensated?
There were about 19,000, just over 19,000 farmers that ultimately were compensated during the second phase of Pigford II. And that, that stretched all across America. As I said, most of the farms were in the South. But I need to mention that sometimes some of the biggest claims meetings we would have in terms of attendance were in places like Chicago and Detroit, Michigan. And, I always wondered how or why that would happen. But in, talking to the farmers, basically, or children of the farmers many times, you would find that these farmers who had been some of the best and most successful entrepreneurs in America, coming out of slavery and just being thrown into the mix and asked to compete, they had overcome obstacles, they worked hard, and they would send their kids off to be educated, to go to college, to get a better life, to learn more, and to advance the family. However, those kids, once they graduated from college, they weren't going back to that rural part of America where, in fact, they knew that daddy and mom had been discriminated against for many years. They were not going to subject themselves to that. So many of those children of the farmers who would normally have been the next generation of farmers moved to the bigger cities, and ultimately their parents retired to those places as well.
Hmm. And Timothy Pigford, whose name was on the original lawsuit and the reopened case, did he ultimately get compensation?
Mr. Pigford never received compensation. In this case, and which is a tragedy in and of itself.
Why wouldn't he have received it?
There were two tracks that you could potentially take. One was actual damages, and the other was kind of the liquidated damages. And Mr. Pigford took the track of the actual damages and was not successful in proving the case. The requirement in order to get actual damages was much higher than it was for the, kind of the liquidated damages, the set damages.
Mm. So there were two tracks. Farmers could opt for the sort of base, like $50,000 settlement, or they could try to get more, but it was riskier because they'd have to prove that they'd had a lot more damages. And
right.
He took the riskier approach and got nothing.
Hmm. Right, exactly.
Well, Greg Francis, now that this case is, you know, it's settled, the work on, you know, on the payments is done. Is this chapter over? Are black farmers today getting what they need from the U.S. Department of Agriculture in, you know, equal to what white farmers are receiving?
No, you know, I will tell you that, you know, the black farmers have referred to the USDA as the last plantation. And just in conversations that I've had with farmers, even recently, it appears that, you know, while this case, the Pickford case, Pickford 2, brought some compensation and brought some awareness that, in fact, they still were being discriminated against. If you look at the prior administration to the Biden administration, less than 1/10 of 1%. Let me repeat that. Less than 1/10 of 1% of all farm aid that was distributed, and we're talking about billions of dollars, to farmers in America went to African-American farmers. So there is still really an issue out there in terms of how the farmers are being awarded the loans and the grants that the government provides to everyone else. And in fact, in the most recent stimulus bill, there was $5 billion that was set aside for debt relief. I think we talked about that before. There was not much debt relief from the Pickford case or in the Pickford case, either of them. So there was $5 billion set aside for debt relief for black farmers, just, you know, kind of to take the onus off of them if in fact they were struggling financially in operating their farms. However, as we know now, that legislation has been held up, or the dissemination of that money has been held up, because the white farmers have filed a lawsuit and claim racial discrimination against them for this debt relief.
Greg Francis, what did you learn from the black farmers you worked for in this case?
You know, the one of the most important things I learned from them is awareness. Most of these farmers, you know, they weren't asking for anything extra or special or anything. They were just asking for to be treated as other Americans should be treated. And they wanted to have their stories told. They wanted to have it told to, you know, so that it wouldn't happen to other black farmers, but also to just let America know what, you know, they had been struggling under. I recall a claims meeting in Oklahoma, and a gentleman was pushed in a wheelchair up to the meeting. I sat or I saw them in line and thought to myself, well, you know, certainly this elderly gentleman, I'm not going to have him wait. I myself volunteered to sit with him, and who I later found out was his daughter, to fill out his claims form. As we sat down, we started the conversation. I looked to his daughter and I said, okay, what's his name? And she gave me the name. And I started asking the questions on the questionnaire that I would have to, that they would have to fill out and ultimately sign. And after about two questions of me looking at her, she put her hand on mine and said, sir, no, my dad is here to talk for himself. And it just made me realize that this was really, you know, whether that money affected this older farmer's life or not, I don't know. But I know that when he left out of that claims meeting that day, he felt a sense of relief and a sense of fulfillment that he had finally been able to tell his story of how he was discriminated against after, you know, serving in the military and coming back home to Oklahoma.
Greg Francis is a personal injury attorney in Florida with the firm Osborne and Francis, and he's author of the book Just Harvest, the story of how black farmers won the largest civil rights case against the U.S. government. Greg Francis was one of the attorneys representing farmers in that case. Thank you for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you, Julie. Thank you for having me. And thank you for, you know, making America aware of, you know, the plight of these black farmers and what they've been through.
This is Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. Coming up next, for something completely different, why scientists are studying squirrels to help robots and humans become more agile.
Thanks for listening to Top of Mind. I'm Ciara Hewlett. Have you ever seen a squirrel fall? doubtful. Squirrels have a remarkable ability to judge distances, leap, and even do parkour. They can land on small ledges and do acrobatics by catching thin bars with their hands. And they can adapt to a changing environment very quickly. Researchers are now studying how they do it so that robots and humans can copy them. Nathaniel Hunt is one of those researchers. He's a professor of biomechanics at the University of Nebraska, Omaha, and he joins me on the line now. Thanks for your time.
Yeah, thank you for your interest. I'm happy to be here and talk about this with you.
You're hoping to improve the agility of robots to be able to do things like search and rescue. Why study squirrels for that? Why not a human gymnast?
Yeah, human gymnasts are amazing too, but there's a lot of differences with a squirrel. One is effects of size. The fact that a squirrel only weighs a couple pounds or a kilogram means that the physics and how they move around the world is a little bit different for them in terms of how much force they can produce per body mass. So they really have a great ability to accelerate. So a squirrel can leap 6 times the length of its own body. So if a human could do that, that would be superhuman capabilities. But squirrels have these really impressive kind of hind muscles in their rear legs that can launch them long distances, but also they can control that and hit targets and land. So if we'd like to better understand squirrels, but also advance robots to the point where we have robots capable of carrying loads and sensors for search and rescue and a kind of environmental monitoring with the ability to go anywhere, then I think squirrels are actually a better model to use for the design of a robot than a humanoid robot.
So you made a squirrel obstacle course, and you went out and you got willing participants of squirrels enticed to them with some peanuts. What did your obstacle course look like?
So we were trying to reproduce the type of precision and measurement that we can get within a laboratory, but do it outdoors with free-ranging squirrels on the woods on the side of the UC Berkeley campus. So we dragged out a large steel wall. We attached different things that the squirrels could jump from and land on with magnets. So we used really strong magnets to attach to the steel wall. And then we also brought out computers and high-speed cameras. So cameras that can record many, many pictures per second, hundreds or even thousands of pictures per second. And that let us have good precise control on the distances between the launching and the landing for the squirrel.
And you could also see exactly what they were doing.
Yeah, exactly. So we had a nice clean background that let us track the body of the squirrel and different features of the squirrel and figure out where the center point of its mass, the center of mass is on the squirrel. And all these things help us to do an analysis, like a physics-based analysis and modeling of the movement of the squirrel.
And what did you learn?
We learned a few different things. We learned that the ability for squirrels to launch and land on something can't be explained simply by their acrobatic biomechanical capabilities, but requires them to make decisions that are flexible. They're jumping from these flexible branches, and they make decisions on where they're going to jump from based on how bendy the branch is and how long the gap is that they have to cross. And they're weighing both of these things simultaneously and making these kind of split-second decisions that they need to have successful jumps and avoid predators like hawks and things.
So squirrels are really smart then, at least when it comes to jumping. They're very smart, making these super quick calculations.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I think we often think of smart as say, being able to play chess really well or something like that. But there's this whole other kind of physical intelligence where squirrels are really kind of a genius in terms of the ability to control their body and move through really challenging environments like what you see in the tops of trees. But that's not to say that they don't make mistakes. And we saw large errors in terms of how the squirrels hitting a target. they often miss a target by up to about half their body length, which is about 15 centimeters. And the way that they can deal with that and not fall is that they have a range of different kinds of landing maneuvers that they use, which are really interesting. Things like if they jump a little too far, they can roll around the top of the branch, or if they jump a little too short, they can swing under the branch and then do kind of a muscle up type maneuver where they pull their bodies up onto the branch. And that lets them deal with imperfect jumps. So they don't have to be perfectly accurate because they have this set of landing maneuvers that helps them deal with these imperfect jumps and not fall out of the trees.
And you never saw them fall in your whole experiment?
Yeah, no squirrels ever fell in the entire experiment.
Wow.
Hundreds of jumps, a variety of different flexibility levels and different gap geometries where they're jumping higher or lower or shorter or longer. And zero falls throughout the entire experiment. They are definitely amazing.
How is what you've learned going to make robots more agile so they can do search and rescue or detect environmental hazards?
Well, one thing that we can do to improve robots is give them additional behavioral flexibility. So what I mean by that is make choices on what kinds of actions to take based on what possibilities are in the environment in front of them. So moving through the complex environment of a tree canopy is very different than moving across the surface of a robotics laboratory. So a flat surface on the ground really simplifies things a great deal. So you don't necessarily need to have the flexibility to make decisions that depend on the mechanical properties or the geometry of the environment. So squirrels are highly sensitive to these things, and they have flexible decision-making and learning of those properties. And they have to be able to learn and sense this information and incorporate it into the strategies that they use. And this is one thing that we can take and try to implement in robots that are inspired by the movements of these animals.
And how could you also apply what you learned to help humans who have grasping or walking impairments?
That is an interesting question. And that's kind of the other side of my research is related to preventing slips and falls in humans. And, you know, it's a huge problem. As we get older, we fall more and more, especially after the age of 65. And a lot of these are due to slips and trips. And what we see here with the squirrels is that their ability to prevent falls is what we call robust, meaning that it's effective despite being caught in these kind of unexpected scenarios where they've jumped too far or jumped too short. And I think from the human falling and fall prevention research side, we can kind of take that home to think in terms of, well, we're not going to prevent slips and prevent falls completely. We can engineer our environments and have sidewalks and railings and things to try to do the best that we can to prevent slips and trips. But what we really need is for people to experience those types of instabilities and learn how they need to move their bodies to recover from those. So instead of just preventing the types of instabilities that lead to falls, but actually focus on learning and decision-making, rapid decision-making on how we can keep someone from actually falling and hitting the ground, or if they do fall and they're going to hit the ground, move in such a way as to prevent injuries like hip fractures and things like that.
Huh. And so instead of focusing so much on fall prevention, which is kind of where we're focused mostly right now, it's focusing more on, okay, if you do fall, what do you do? How can you move your body so that you don't get as hurt?
Yeah, exactly. And I think squirrels are kind of the pinnacle of animal balance and the ability to land and not fall. And if they're doing it without being perfectly accurate and while experiencing these types of instabilities, then that's kind of what we should aim for humans as well.
Nathaniel Hunt is a professor of biomechanics at the University of Nebraska, Omaha. Thank you so much for your time today. It was really great to chat with you.
Thank you. It's fun.
I'm Ciara Hewlett.
And I'm Julie Rose. And that's it for our show today. Top of Mind is a production of BYU Radio. Cleon Wall, Ciara Hewlett, and Kyle Riemond produced the show. We'd love to connect with you on social media. We're on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at BYU Top of Mind. We'll talk soon.